Uh-oh. Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio. This is the Steve Cochran Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Start with the obvious. Thank God you're here and not there. Houston, fourth largest city in the country by population, is under attack from Mother Nature in flooding that is being called the thousand-year flood, epic by biblical standards. Very, very rough time ahead because we're only about halfway through the storm, apparently. Let's do the top 6 and 6 right away here because we're going to go live to Houston in about 10 minutes. And hi, by the way, I'm Steve. Welcome back, Steve. Thanks.
Welcome back, Steve.
Hi, Steve. Glad to have you back.
Hi, Steve. Thanks. Were you gone?
Oh. Yes, I was.
Oh, wow.
Just kidding.
Yes, I was. Now this.
From the Steve Cochran Auditorium in the lovely Sunrise Hotel, it's time to get your kicks. With the top 6 at 6. Sponsored by American Weathermakers, the home of the 60 Minute Man.
So the top 6 at 6, sponsored as always by the fine, fine people at American Weathermakers. Thousands of rescue missions have been launched across a huge swath of Texas, with more than 3,000 National and State Guard troops who have been deployed to assist with relief effort. You just don't hear this. You don't hear the authorities in a disaster go, if you've got a boat, we need you now. No, we're not asking for training. We're not asking for vetting. We're not asking for screening. We're not going to make you fill out a bunch of government paperwork. This is neighbors helping neighbors helping neighbors. Get in your boat, go door to door in your neighborhood, save lives.
It's unbelievable. How about people who if 911 emergency responders couldn't respond or couldn't get to them?
Yeah.
So they're sending out word on Twitter and Facebook, need help.
Right. Yeah, exactly. There was a picture yesterday that came out that will break your heart that you look at that you think is a monster movie. It's ridiculous. It is a flooded nursing home.
Oh, God.
And it came out last night, and it is largely elderly women and a group of about 7, 8, 9 of them in a nursing home. And the woman that ran the nursing home took the picture and sent it out on social media like you're talking about to just beg for help. Now, all the people in that photo and the people in that nursing home supposedly have been moved and rescued. But you're talking about people who have very great difficulty getting around, sitting in large overstuffed chairs that are now up to their laps in water.
Yeah, a couple of them were actually in wheelchairs, and there was a woman who was sitting on one of the couches with her really up to her waist in water,
right,
crocheting or knitting.
Yeah, just trying to distract herself from what was going on.
Yeah. Heartbreaking.
It's absolutely as bad as you've heard, it's not going to get better anytime soon. The National Weather Service predicted that parts of Texas could receive another 20 to 25 inches of rain. The peak, we're talking about certain areas, 50 inches of rain over the course of 5 days.
Never before ever. Never. Unprecedented ever. Never.
Right. The thousand-year storm.
Right.
President Trump next. President Trump expected to travel to Texas tomorrow. There'll be people criticizing that trip. There'll be people praising that trip. The best case scenario for this trip would be if the president gets in and gets out and expresses his concern and his empathy. This is not a photo op for the president. This is the president doing the right thing, and he should be supported in that fact. There's some great archival footage of President Johnson in the 60s.
I don't know which hurricane it was, but it was the mid-60s, where he goes in, and it was Louisiana, and he goes in on a boat, and he's rescuing people. The president of the United States rescuing people from homes. Don't expect Donald Trump to do that. I wouldn't think he should. But he will be there tomorrow as scheduled, at least right now. Legislative leaders here still working on the finer points of a plan to send money to public schools. Their efforts risk being derailed with ongoing fights between Governor Rauner and Mayor Emanuel and union pressure. Sunday, yesterday, Republican leaders tried to downplay the ugliness as they headed in the latest round of closed-door negotiations at the Capitol, saying dissatisfaction on both sides was a sign of compromise. Okay, good for you. A vote on the proposal could come as early as today in the House, and it looks like the House Republican leader, Mr. Durkin, did a fine job of trying to hold this together as it was coming apart at the seams. Next. No surprise here, Dave. Floyd Mayweather stopped Conor McGregor in the 10th round?
Yes. Yeah.
No surprise it took that long?
Well, surprise it took that long. That was...
Did Conor McGregor, was he allowed to kick him at any time?
He was not allowed to kick him.
So this is just straight boxing?
It was boxing. Yeah. He
so why would we even assume Conor McGregor would even be competitive in this? And how in God's name did it go 10 rounds? And who decided when Conor McGregor would be done?
Well, the referee decided that.
Yeah, I don't think so. Maybe Don King.
You think
so?
Who
was the promoter?
You think so?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'll tell you what, it created the buzz, the payday, everything they wanted out of this, they got.
Floyd Mayweather allegedly tried to bet $400,000 in cash on himself.
And they wouldn't let him.
Well, of course they wouldn't let him. It's ridiculous.
No, he said he went to the sports book during the day.
Well, he's an idiot. Of course they wouldn't let him. You can't let the guy in the fight bet money against or on himself.
No,
you can't.
You really can't do that.
Next. This is a terrible story. Driver goes around cones, hits a couple of triathlon cyclists on Lakeshore Drive. A 20-year-old woman was cited with negligent driving Sunday after police say she hit two cyclists participating in the Chicago triathlon. Do you actually think the cones are there to ruin your day? Do you think the cones are there just because you've got to get somewhere and they're trying to stop you? That's ridiculous. Yeah. And you don't get an excuse because you're 20 years old and you're not old enough to know better. You're 20 years old. If you're old enough to drive a car, you're old enough to understand that traffic barriers, traffic signs, traffic signals, traffic cops, they matter, and you pay attention to them.
And I know it's an inconvenience, but you know what? That's part of living in Chicago.
It's part of being a grown-up.
We have great events, and this is one of the great events.
It's ridiculous.
During the late summer, and just deal with it.
This young woman is going to be charged with a number of crimes if she hasn't been already, and she should be. And then there's this. This is really an amazing number. The top 12 films, not two films, the top 12 films in the North American box office statistics for the weekend, earned less than $50 million. It is the lowest weekend total since 2001. And I believe this number is the lowest total since the aftermath of 9/11, when people were staying home. They weren't going to movies, they weren't going anywhere. The top 12 films, less than $50 million. The Hitman's Bodyguard was number one, whatever.
Is this a statement on the quality of films or just the changing way we consume films?
I think it's the perfect storm there, pardon the pun, because I don't do puns. But it's a combination of a really bad collection of movies and people staying home in summer.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, the whole state outside. Of Texas couldn't go to a movie.
And Texas couldn't go to a movie. That's exactly right.
There's a lot going on.
Top six brought to you by American Weathermakers Heating and Cooling, the 60-Minute Men. And we'll give you a desktop indoor weather station brought to you by American Weathermakers Heating and Cooling, the 60-Minute Men. If you're the sixth caller now at 312-981-7200, Ryan Burrow, our own Ryan Burrow from here in ABC News, joins us next on 720 WGN.
The Steve Cochran Show.
The best way that you can help the first responders and people out there, municipal employees out there who are trying to take care of you, is to stay off the road. I certainly want to acknowledge and thank neighbors and Samaritans who have been out there and assisting as well. Quite frankly, it takes all of us.
6:25, we are attempting to connect with Ryan Burrow in Houston and ABC News. You can imagine the mess there just in regards to trying to coordinate media. The media, by the way, has done a nice job as well. CNN crews rescued several people this weekend as well on their own boats as they go around and tried to tell the story. The governor of Texas did the same. It's the pictures are just they just do not look real. You know, obviously they are, but they do not look real. To try to give you some perspective over the area of rain here, it's as if there were 10 to 15 to 20 inches or more of rain from Chicago to Peoria, because Corpus Christi, I think, is maybe even more than that. Corpus Christi might be 4 hours away, and that whole area was overspread with that kind of rain and devastation. Ryan Burrow in Texas, where are you?
I'm actually at an evacuation center in Houston right now where thousands of people have come in. They're wet. They're wet from the flooding. They're wet from the rain that continues to fall. We had a little bit of a break from the rain yesterday afternoon for about an hour and a half, 2 hours. But essentially, it has been raining nonstop here since Friday. And many of the people, are unable to drive through. You have to understand something that, if you get water in your home, a lot of the roadways are flooded out. A lot of the cars are flooded out. You can't call a taxi or an Uber to come pick you up and bring you to the evacuation center. These people are walking 2-3 miles to get to a bus stop where they can be picked up by a bus to be brought to an evacuation center. Many of them with garbage bags full of their possessions, many of them with pets as well, just trying to get into these evacuation centers. And it's going to be a while that they're going to be here because these rains seem to be in the forecast for the next few days. We could see another 20, 25 inches.
I used to spend a fair amount of time in Houston, and the problem with Houston is the water's got nowhere to go. It is a huge, huge city by way of area, and the majority of it, frankly, is concrete. It's concrete and buildings everywhere. There are bayous here and bayous there, and there's a couple of significant rivers, and obviously the Gulf is not far away. But there's no way for the water to run off. So downtown has to be completely you probably can't get there, right? You can't get there, you can't get out?
Exactly. I mean, I came out with the ABC TV crew because, we're trying to work in numbers. They got flooded out yesterday. They got stuck in a situation where they couldn't get out. They got to an area, they shot some stories, and then they couldn't get out. Rescuers had to come get them out, and then the rescuers had to be rescued as well. So, imagine if a third or even half of Chicago roadways were flooded out and try to get around that. It's nearly impossible. They're telling people not to get out on the streets. They don't want to have to make these water rescues. In the meantime, they're rescuing people in their homes, and they're telling people, look, don't call 911 if you're waist-deep in water or if you're hanging out on the second floor. Only call us if you're in life-threatening situations. They've already rescued more than 2,000 people, or at least answered 2,000 calls. They've got a few more hundred going on today, and that's in Houston alone. That doesn't even factor in the suburbs and all the way down to Corpus Christi.
How important are these locals with boats?
Very important, because that's pretty much the eyes and ears of the neighborhood, and it's going to be up to people with boats, with these ex-military style vehicles, these Humvees, which a lot of people apparently have, or at least loaning to these neighborhoods, and then the helicopters are constantly scanning and looking for people on rooftops. This storm did not discriminate as far as a section or an area of Houston. It has been dumping water consistently on this city for days now, and so literally we're talking about the entire span of this city that has needed help in one form or another.
So you get someone from your neighborhood in a boat, and how do they know where to take them? Are cell phone lines working?
Yeah. Actually, the one thing that has been functioning well is power and cell phones. They seem to be working. I think only about 3% of the city lost power. But here's the deal. If you're one of these guys with a boat and you can pick up a few neighbors, you bring them to a dry spot, and then you say, okay, I got to go get more people.
Okay.
And then this dry spot, these people walk to one of these bus points where they can be picked up and brought to a shelter. Or some of these people are just hoofing it to friend's house or family or relative's house that are miles away. And even in those situations, how do you know that your friends or your relatives home is fine? They could be in the flood area a day from now. So it's been a real struggle, and more struggles to come in the coming days.
In New Orleans with Katrina, there was a problem with critters, water critters flooding into residential areas, snakes in particular, things of that nature. Is that an issue?
No, not yet, but it is kind of strange watching kind of wildlife right now. There's this bridge in Houston, you may be familiar with it, where all these bats live, and the bridge is essentially underwater now, and you can hear these bats squealing and yelping. They can't get out.
Right.
So those bats probably will not survive this storm. And it's interesting too to see bugs trying to crawl out of the water to dry land in formation. It's very, very strange. This is a very odd scenario right now.
There have been a lot of shots of people rescuing their pets, and
I'll bet
some of that is there was a shot last night of a guy holding a couple of kennels with two dogs in each one, and he's going through waist-deep water holding the kennels. He's
trying to get to a dry spot.
Trying to get to keep them alive. I mean, it's just terrible.
That's created another issue here, by the way, Dave, at the shelter, because a lot of people are arriving on buses with dogs in hand, and the shelter wasn't allowing these dogs to be in here because there are people with allergies. You know.
Sure.
It's a health situation. So the idea was those people were all standing outside waiting for further information as the rains were about to kick back up again. But the idea was they're basically handing their pets over to a special organization that's going to maintain them until, you know, they can safely be picked up again. But, you know, a lot of these dogs have special issues with health and diet and stuff like that. And some of these owners are hesitant to hand their dog over.
There is the heartbreaking scenario of people not being able to get a hold of people they love in that area. Is the Red Cross still the go-to place for just about everything, whether you want to help or whether you need information? What do you do?
Yeah, Red Cross is the one kind of facilitating all of the relief efforts at this point. But in emergency situations, obviously they're telling people to call 911. Obviously, the county sheriff and the city police and fire departments, they're doing the best they can to help people out. But yeah, once the rescue is made, it's up to the Red Cross. And people are coming. They're making donations, diapers, bottled water, clothing, things like that. And they're welcoming any of that. At this point, we don't have anything that we can tell you. You know, this city needs X or Y.
Sure.
And to be honest with you, that could change in the coming days.
Today was supposed to be the first day of school in Houston. Who knows how long it'll be before that happens?
I'd be surprised if it happens in the next week.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, guys, the FEMA is holding a news conference right now, and they've just announced that they expect to have 450,000 registers on their disaster list. So these are people who have sought disaster help in some way or another get put on a list. 450,000.
Wow.
And FEMA says that this is right now, they're not even talking about loss of life. They're saying this mission is still a life safety, life sustaining, life rescuing mission for FEMA and all of the emergency responders.
And we'll check back with you, Ryan, soon.
All right, take care.
Thanks, Ryan Burrow, live in Texas, doing great work as always. And by the way, Steve, you mentioned FEMA. The head of FEMA is a man named one of the head administrators. Is he the lead FEMA guy now, Brock Long?
He's the guy in charge of FEMA nationally.
Yeah, told CNN this weekend a pretty amazing thing. Listen.
National Weather Service says that parts of Texas might be uninhabitable for weeks, even potentially months after the hurricane. Is FEMA prepared to be there for months on end?
FEMA is going to be there for years, sir. This disaster recovery, this disaster is going to be a landmark event. And we're already in the stages. While we're focused on response right now and helping Texas, you know, respond, we're already pushing forward recovery housing teams. We're already pushing forward forces to be on the ground to implement National Flood Insurance Program policies as well and doing the inspections that we need. So we're setting up and gearing up for the next couple years.
Andrea is off this week. Big story is next, 720 WGN.
I have edema on my thigh, pink stuff in my eye, and I need you now. I've got a stomach pain that's low, fungus on my toe, and I need you now.
It's Dr. Kevin Mose, sponsored by Northwestern Medicine, making people better by making medicine better. And Dr. Kevin Mose joins us now. You have friends in Houston, Doc?
You know what? We both do. Well, not Houston, San Antonio, Tom Byram.
Oh, there you go.
Yep. Tom and Dana live there, and actually their daughter lives in Sugarland, which is right outside of Houston. So
it's
unfortunately in Calgary, so he's not concerned. I talked to him yesterday.
The fourth largest city by population in the country, not that far behind us, by the way. And imagine dumping that kind of water on Chicago and hope to God that it never happens. So your prayers are needed. All right, I want to hit you with something before we jump to the topic here.
Yeah.
And I texted you this last night. I don't know if this is a bigger deal just for hospital revenues or if it's a bigger deal for patients, but Anthem, the Blue Cross Blue Shield provider, the company, is no longer going to pay for MRIs and CT scans performed on an outpatient basis in hospitals across the country. They're saying it's because hospitals, you guys charge too much, and it'll be cheaper and therefore help healthcare costs to do it on an outpatient basis at clinics and strip malls and, you know, various other places where they're provided. But to me, it creates an issue if, and tell me if I'm right or wrong about this, if I come into you and I need an MRI or a CT scan and you go, well, we can't do that here, get in your car and go down the street or wherever.
It will. It'll definitely fragment care. So I think of it even the other way. Even you're in the hospital, you have a medical condition, we do an MRI on you. Now you're discharged and we need to have a follow-up MRI on an outpatient basis, and we can't do it at the same place. So there's no comparison that can be made. You're having different people read it on different machines, and you just can't do that. So that's going to be one of the problems. Anthem is looking at this from more than just imaging as well. They have an app where you can find out what the lowest cost is for medications, for laboratory, for x-rays, for procedures. So there's definitely going to be a push to try to decrease the expenses out of, decrease the activity out of hospitals.
Well, there's parts of that that make sense, right? But there's also parts of it that medically don't make sense. So who gets to decide what goes?
Yeah, it is going to be the insurers. You know, there's always this healthy tension between providers and insurers. And you have to realize, too, people say, well, why is it so much more expensive at a hospital? Well, there's a bunch of reasons. One, we have to man that 24/7. Two, we have federal regulations that these places and strip malls are not going to have. So our staffing, our building requirements, our joint commission requirements, we try to keep the state-of-the-art equipment here. We try to make sure that we have the best. I can tell you, if you have an MRI done at Central DuPage of your brain, it's going to be run by a fellowship-trained neuroradiologist.
Right.
So we have the specialized care as well.
Yeah, and honestly, look, everybody's opinions are what they are, and you're all entitled to them. But you get what you pay for when it comes to health care as well. And I'm not advocating the highest possible cost for things, but I do think it has to make sense. And I would be concerned if insurance companies suddenly started to go back to, it's a revenue-based model. It's not a are-you-okay-or-not-okay model.
Oh, absolutely. And people have to realize, too, the vast majority of hospitals in this country have very razor-thin margins. You're talking 1%, 2%, 3%,
right,
maybe. And a lot of their margin is coming from imaging. So when that gets taken away, you're going to see things starting to get cut. I mean, just look what's happened here in the Chicagoland market in the past 6 months. You know, Advocate earlier in the year, you know, talked about a $200 million cut. Just recently, Edward Elmhurst, a $50 million cut in a hiring freeze on 300 people. We're talking about hospitals getting squeezed right now from the insurers, from Affordable Care Act, and just costs are going up. It's a tough business to be in right now.
We'll come back in just a second after traffic and tackle another important topic, as Doc does every Monday. Dr. Kevin Most, Northwestern Medicine, making people better by making medicine better. All right, Doc, let's talk medical marijuana, because there's not enough for the people in Springfield to argue about.
Right.
So, how many states now have approved medical marijuana?
Well, 29 states have approved medical marijuana, and then a total of 44 states allow the use of something called CBD, which is one of the chemicals that's in marijuana, to be used. So, but 29 states right now have approved it, and the other ones are, a lot of them are looking at it.
And where are we in Illinois?
We approve it. We've approved it. And matter of fact, in Illinois, we have probably one of the wider lists of approved medical conditions that can be treated. I think we're up to about 40, if I'm not mistaken.
So do all of the conditions have to be approved on a case-by-case basis, or a condition-by-condition basis, I should say?
Correct. Correct. That you have to have a medical condition, and a doctor has to verify that by examining you and doing the appropriate tests needed for that. And then he would write a letter of certification for you saying, yes, you have this condition, and you are approved to use medical marijuana.
And there's got to be medical people involved in that. It's not like the people in Springfield know what's medically appropriate or isn't.
Totally. Yep, the physician. And the physician is actually responsible then to monitor you while you're taking the medical marijuana as well, to show that it's improving or to show what's going on with your symptoms or the disease process.
So we have plenty of regulation on this. What is the pushback into making this more readily available for more things? Because I assume there's a list of things that it ought to be available for.
Yeah, you know, and when you really look at what it is available for and the changes that it can make and the impact it can make on someone's life, It's we have to get over that this is a bad drug and, you know, used properly in the right fashion for the right people, non-recreational. I'm talking about just the medicinal side of it. It really makes an impact on people. I mean, there's a whole list of conditions that people won't argue with at all, saying, yes, this helps. There's others where it says, oh, fibromyalgia, okay, it helps. But, you know, that's the soft science. But there's hard science behind many other conditions that it is important on. And, you know, they're always talking about this is a gateway drug. This is a gateway drug, and that's why we can't do it. And you know, the argument on the other side is this isn't a gateway drug. The only reason it's a gateway drug is because of the distribution process where you have to go on the street and buy it illegally from a drug dealer, and now this individual is trying to sell you something else.
And honestly, I get it. I get why people are concerned about it. You certainly don't want a bigger drug problem in this country than we already have. But if there is a medical need for meds, the people that are abusing opioids in this country make marijuana look like a walk in the park.
Totally. And to be honest with you, quite a few people have been able to get off of opiates and because of their use of marijuana. Jim McMahon is a perfect example. You talk to him about how opiates were running his life, and now he openly will tell you how often he smokes marijuana and that he hasn't used opiates and that he doesn't need the pain medication. That story is over and over. He just happens to be a celebrity.
It's a big deal for little kids who are sick too, right?
It is. You know, when we look at kids that are sick, and we also look at adults that are taking chemotherapy, chemotherapy makes you feel extremely nauseated, and it makes you feel terrible. The marijuana, the THC, takes down a lot of that nausea, and that's twofold. One, it makes them feel better. Two, it allows them to eat because it also stimulates their appetite. Caloric intake for people with cancer. How many times have you seen somebody with cancer and said, oh my gosh, you know, he's down to 100 pounds?
Yep.
Well, it's because they're nauseated and they're not feeling well. The marijuana allows them to take away that nausea and also stimulates their appetite so that they put on weight, or at least they try to maintain the weight as they're going through this terrible treatment.
I was at a family wedding this weekend, and somebody was using medical marijuana there for glaucoma and other eye conditions. Is that even expanding in regards to vision?
It is. And, you know, we've known that for years. We've known that since the 70s when a big study was done. And the interesting thing there is glaucoma is a disease that causes blindness. And as we age, we have a higher chance of getting it, although you can still get it when you're young. But as you age, you can't. The problem with glaucoma medications is I don't know how you are in putting eye drops in, but I'm not any good at it. It hits my forehead. I blink. It does that. That's the medication that we're trying to get in you. So think about a senior that's trying to do that and trying to remember to do it four times a day. So those medications, not only that, at least some of them are generic, but a lot of the newer ones are expensive, where marijuana is fairly inexpensive.
Doc, does it reduce inflammation, the THC, or is it reducing the pain caused by the inflammation?
Dave, it's a great question because it actually appears to do a few things. In glaucoma, it just actually allows the pressure to be lowered in the eye. But a lot of the other areas where it's being used, arthritis is a big one. You know, it's taking down inflammation, actually. The science behind it we're unsure of yet. But probably the more exciting thing is what's going on with concussions, what's going on with stroke patients, and potentially what's going on with Alzheimer's patients because of its activity in the brain. Not so much taking down inflammation, not so much relieving pain, but binding at sites in the brain that are causing other problems.
Seizures, anxiety disorders, PTSD, ulcerative colitis, all of these things can be positively impacted by medical marijuana. So look, if we know that there's tight regulations on this, and we know that doctors, in our experience, have been doing their job, and we know that Illinois has been fairly liberal about this. Frankly, Doc, we also know that if we grow it as a cash crop and we tax it, there's more money to be made for a state that's flat broke. I don't see a lot of downside here.
No. And to be honest with you, it's safer. These individuals now that are going out in the street that are getting it, unfortunately, drug dealers are lacing theirs. In the state-owned ones, the quality control is much tighter. And you do. You talk about someone that has seizures, and taking seizure medication can often make you drowsy, can make you feel bad. You know, this allows you to stop your seizures. We're using it in Parkinson's patients because it allows them to have better fine motor skills.
we have to, I'm not a huge drug advocate, and I'll be totally honest with you, you'll all laugh, but I've never had marijuana ever in my life.
Neither have I.
And everyone's like, yeah, right, sure. But
well, especially in me. You imagine when I tell people that, but I haven't.
Yeah. But when you look at the studies and you look at how it can impact patients, it's time that we change, and it's time that we look at the opportunities here to really impact some patients' lives.
Well said by you, and let your legislators know that's how you feel if, in fact, you do agree. Doc, great information. Thank you, buddy.
You got it, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Dr. Kevin Most from Northwestern Medicine, impacting people every day because they're making people better by making medicine better. And we're back with the news, and Dan Hampton next, and more from Houston as the Steve Cochran Show continues on 720 WGN.
The Steve Cochran Show.
Pete McMurray, Jane Monzura, Steve Cochran back on Monday. Danimal, always brought to you by your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealers. Hamp, how are you, man?
Pete, it is so great to visit with you. And I guess Steve will be back on Monday after he gets his personality transplant.
Oh!
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 Yeah, he's lucky he's a Hall of Famer and could kill me with his bare hands. Otherwise, he'd be in serious trouble.
Hello, buddy.
How you doing, Mr. Cochran?
Sponsored by ChevyDriveChicago.com. I don't know if you ever find yourself in upstate New York, Hamp, but I played a golf course yesterday. You need to play. And they played a PGA B tour stop there for a couple of years. It's the Turning Stone Resort and Casino.
I've been there, yeah.
And there's a couple of great championship-level golf courses there, the Kaluyat, and I believe the other is the Atunde for the Oneida tribe there. But anyway, keep it in the back of your mind, Hamp. As much as you love golf, that needs to go on your must-play list.
You know what? Probably by October, Mike Glennon and I will have some extra time. We'll head up there.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. All right, so listen. Yeah. The Chicago Bears, obviously the injury's not good, but the Chicago Bears look like a professional football team this weekend.
Absolutely. And, you know, for all Bear fans, it's really been a best-case scenario. First and foremost, we have to address the quarterback situation. Mike Glennon held off the kid, Mitchell Trubisky, at least for another couple of weeks with a very strong opening drive, 15-play drive with three third-down conversions through the air. There was a lot of good stuff. But all that being said, the rest of the team really starting to come along. It's preseason. They don't matter, but they do matter because you're showing a level of being prepared and being willing to engage and commit and do a lot of the good stuff that eventuates to win. So the first team defense, you know, they got to a number of quarterbacks over the 3 weeks. They've allowed one touchdown. Right now, and you kind of hit on it, when Cam Meredith went down yesterday, that's one of the worst things that could have really happened because this year, this team really needed to kind of lean on him, and obviously he'll be out for the year. That means that third-year player Kevin Wright, a former first-round draft pick, has got to grow up. He's got to just zip it and go out and prepare every day like he's the number one because, in a way, it's been placed on his shoulders. He's got to be able to get open. He's got to be able to do all the things that a number one receiver for an NFL team has got to do.
You know, the fact that we're talking about the loss of Cameron Meredith being as significant a blow as it is really a great tribute to Cameron Meredith. I mean, if he'd said 2 years ago that this loss would be as significant as it is for the Bears, I think people would have looked at you funny. But he was their best of a questionable group. And so aside from Kevin White now, there are some guys who have certainly shown some flashes, Tanner Gentry among them. But who else do you look at? Is Victor Cruz even in the mix on this team, Dan?
Well, I kept waiting for him to kind of jump out from the pack and reemerge. We all know he's had knee issues. That's why the Giants you know, let him go. And sooner or later, you know, you expect a player of that stature to kind of regain his form. Well, he hasn't yet. He had a big drop yesterday that really would have kept the offense going, kept him on the field. You know, a lot of little bitty things like that has really kind of told me that Victor Cruz isn't the Victor Cruz we saw 4 years ago, okay? And that happens. But Kendall Wright, who, you know, we signed from Tennessee, had a good game yesterday.
Yep.
And the young man that you named, Tanner Gentry, all through training camp, if you were to poll the writers and the media, this essentially they're every day watching this team at practice after practice, two guys would have jumped out. One was Tariq Cohen, the young running back that was really turning heads in the preseason games, and Tanner Gentry. This kid, I saw him on the sidelines the other day. He almost looks like a skinny linebacker. He's about 6'3", 215, and he's got some speed. He ran by the corner of the Titans yesterday and caught that beautiful 45-yard bomb from Trubisky. So he's another kid that's got to be able to emerge and make a statement. And he, as a young player, and Steve, you know how this is in your world on the radio market, sooner or later there's going to be an opportunity. And you've got to not only open that door and walk through, sure, you've got to kick the door open and say, hey, here I am. It's a shame about Cam Meredith, but there's nothing we can do about it now. Here I am. Let me help us win. And if one or two or three of these young kids kick that door open and make a statement, this offense could really be pretty good. We've got five running backs. I don't know how we're going to keep them all. Jordan Howard ran the ball hard yesterday. Cunningham, I've already mentioned the young kid, Tariq Cohen, but, you know, Jeremy Langford, been hurt all training camp. He looked like a starting running back yesterday. He was banging it away. So there's a lot of good stuff, the offensive line. But we've got to be able to find some receivers that can help us. Don't be shocked if they try to, you know, find somebody here this week and potentially make a trade.
The remaining preseason, is it more important to get a sense of what the defense is doing or the offense is doing?
I got to tell you, this Thursday game is not going to be a whole lot of information come off of it. This is going to be the audition for the also rants. And, you know, you're not going to really even see a lot of the starters. And so you're not going to know much. But this team, I think they know who the final 55 will be. There's been some really good stories on the defensive side. You know, that Robertson Harris, he made another play yesterday after a couple of sacks last week. This kid made the team blocking the punt. Jonathan Buller looks like he will start as a five technique and an interior pass rusher. Eddie Jackson from Alabama, I think he was a fifth-round pick, playing like a one or a two. I mean, he's made an impact whenever he's been on the field in practice and through the preseason. Anytime he's given a chance. So there's a lot of the equation has been basically added up. There's still going to be some guys. And again, some of these young receivers, like Tanner Gentry, he needs to get 30, 40, 50 snaps this week because we're going to need him.
Sure. It's Dan Hampton. He's a Hall of Famer. He knows more stuff than we do. That's why we have him on the show. Plus, he's great. He's entertaining. He's funny. And he's a swell guy. Except for that part where he takes shots at me.
I didn't understand that.
That was out of nowhere.
I didn't know the tape was rolling.
The tape is always rolling.
Seven 27, cloudy morning in Chicago, peak of the sun now, and rain here should not be complained about once by any of us, as the people in Houston continue to fight for their property and, more importantly, their lives as this nightmare in Houston continues. We'll check back in with Ryan Burrow in Texas as time allows, along with his ABC duties this morning. Let's go to Springfield in general here with the Republican leader, Mr. Durkin. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
I have heard very positive things about your efforts through sources that I trust in getting this funding mess behind us for schools. You're a modest guy, but take a little credit here if it's due, or give credit to others.
Well, I put some work into it, but I'll thank my caucus as well as holding strong over the last 2 weeks. But part of the job of being a leader is you've got to put an extra effort in it. So I've been doing a lot of work, offline to bring a negotiated settlement to this education funding crisis that we've been living in. But I've done a little more work in this than I have in other major issues. Sure.
So how do you feel about where we are today?
It still is we met again yesterday. We're going to meet again in about an hour. We, meeting the four leaders, I think we'll be able to get there. I think it's going to be a close vote. The teachers unions have gotten involved and are fighting it tooth and nail because of a school choice option that we have for the low income families of Illinois who are desperately seeking a better education for their children. And out of a $6 billion or so that we spend on public education, they're fighting a bill over a $75 million temporary pilot program for school choice. It's amazing. These are the same people who are fighting it are the same people who had no problems voting for a permanent income tax increase 2 months ago on Illinoisans. But when it comes to providing a school choice for low-income families, it's the sky's falling. I'm just blown away by it, Steve.
Yeah, and at some point you have to call that out, and I'm sure you have in these meetings, but when the four leaders get together, what matters, too, is what Madigan and Cullerton decide to take up and not take up. Are they fighting you on anything in particular?
No. They say that they have problems with inner caucus because of that, but the fact is they are committed to getting this done, though. And I'm pleased by that. I've been working all weekend with my members, just getting them up to speed on the bill, but also getting their support. So we're going to find out in a few hours of where we're at, but I think that we'll get there. The governor has been very involved with this. The governor is the one who asked me to, and my counterpart in the Senate, to bring closure to this issue, find a good deal for all Illinoisans. And, you know, I said yesterday that everyone wins in this. Every family and every school in the state of Illinois wins. No one loses.
Well, the win one, right, is to keep them open and to keep kids in school. And beyond that, it's to properly fund them on a fair and equitable basis. The mayor obviously wants the best deal he can get for the city. The governor is trying to fix whatever staff problems he have, and there's been plenty in the past month. So a lot of this falls on you four leaders to figure it out. What's the relationship with the four leaders and the mayor and the city?
You know, it's interesting. It's a good question. You know, the relationship it's a business relationship.
Right.
And we go at it one issue at a time. We have our moments in the public where we will speak our minds on issue. But the fact is, we look at this as it's an objective that we have to get done. Everybody knows what their responsibilities are over the next 24 hours. I don't think anyone is backpedaling. I think that each caucus has their own inherent problems with it, but this is what you need to do. You need to be the leader. You need to be able to get the votes to get this done, because we can't afford to have schools closing their doors, not opening, but closing their doors anytime soon. But, you know, this is a fundamental responsibility of the legislature to make sure schools are going to be properly funded and kids are going to have the best opportunity in education.
Nobody loves the farmers downstate and the regular folks downstate who aren't farming. We're all eating their food. And nobody loves the regular people, the hardworking people south of I-80 more than I do. But so often it's a political football, right? It's a political football that's used, and the city gets this and we don't get that. The truth is somewhere in the middle, as it is on most arguments. So this balance for what the city gets in this funding situation that you hope to finalize here in the next day or so, is the mayor going to be able to accept it, or is he going to continue to fight it?
No, the mayor is going to accept it.
Well, that's good news.
He is going to accept it. The way I look at this is that the mayor is going to be taken care of, and so is CPS. But Republicans, for the first time in over 30 years, will have an opportunity for school choice to put that into law, to have a to deal with this, you know, the constant complaining about unfunded mandates, which we would now have a process that's going to allow schools to rid themselves of the Leif Erikson Day or whatever it is that they're forced to, you know, the multitude of unfunded mandates that come down the road. Sure. We are going to get a property tax referendum freeze for school districts. And I can go down the list, but these are things which we have never had a chance ever of getting even a hearing in a committee. We are now right on the verge of making those the law of Illinois. So we win some good things in here. We Republicans.
And here's the deal too. And I would encourage everybody in the state to hear this, whether you're Republican, Democrat, or agnostic, as most of you know are. But the fact of the matter is, as broken as the state has been, this is the way it has to be fixed, by people sitting down and talking it out and trying to figure it out. So let's see if you guys got it right. Let's see how this plays out. Because in most bills and in big law changes, it takes weeks, months, sometimes years to realize the benefits from them. This will be obvious fairly quickly, I think, Mr. Durkin, if it works or doesn't work.
I think so. We're going to find out this afternoon in the House. We believe that we'll be voting on it sometime after 12 noon in the House of Representatives. And if we're successful, it'll go to the Senate tomorrow. So we'll find out very soon, but we're all working very hard to get our votes together to make sure that this bill is in the proper place to be presented to the legislature. And you know, just got to work up until the last minute, and that's what I plan to do.
All right, now I'm going to say this is the last thing here, and I hope you're sitting down, because what I'm about to say is fairly shocking, but it's coming out of my mouth. I salute Mr. Madigan for working with the Republicans to try to get this done. Now, you might be saying,
I didn't hear you.
I said I salute Mr. Madigan for working with the Republicans and trying to get this done and do the right thing. There you go, Mr. Madigan. I just said a nice thing about you.
I'm on right now, but no, really, look, everyone is doing the right thing, Speaker, the President, and let's just get this done.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. Go back to work.
Thank you.
There you go. It's Jim Durkin, the Republican leader of the House. And Ryan Nobles, our friend from CNN, standing by. You know, before we get to all these terribly important topics, and they are, obviously, Houston and the politics and the remodel of the White House, where they put the revolving door in, apparently. let me go a little lighter for a second. How was your vacation?
We had so much fun, Steve. I can report that all four of my children still have two functioning eyeballs, so... We appropriately used the glasses, and the eclipse was everything as advertised. To watch it in complete totality was totally worth the trip, and I think it's something my kids are going to remember for the rest of their lives. So a good time had by all.
Well,
thanks for asking.
It's great to hear. And this was in Columbia, South Carolina, if I remember right, where you guys were?
No, we went to Clemson, South Carolina, home
Clemson.
Of the national champion Clemson Tigers. We could see their football stadium from where we watched the eclipse. So, yeah, great time.
Over the weekend, Friday night, the president made three or four pretty amazing moves, amazing in quotes. All of those are worthy of political discussion, but let's do traffic here and let's come back and let's start with Houston. And you can tell me what your knowledge is of where we go from here in this horrible, horrible situation that Houston is in. It's Ryan Nobles, our friend from CNN. Ryan Nobles with us from CNN. And Ryan, one of the problems in Houston this morning is pure physics, and that is that the water in two major flood control, ironically titled flood control dams, around one of the bayous, the Buffalo Bayou, the water in those dams is creating such pressure that the water has to be released. Well, it's being released into this Buffalo Bayou, which is this fairly small, I guess we'd call it a stream or a creek. It's called a bayou in the south in these flat, low-lying areas. Means thousands and thousands of other homes are going to be flooded more quickly. And maybe they wouldn't have been, maybe they would. It's hard to say. But there's no way to avoid it, right? I mean, this just has to happen.
I mean, this is just a natural disaster at the highest proportions. And I think where we stand right now is that we just don't know how much more worse it's going to get. The rain just keeps coming. There's a chance that the storm could actually kick back out into the Gulf of Mexico and then fire back up again as a hurricane. I mean, it really is a worst-case scenario for people in Texas. And not that Donald Trump's political fortunes are that important, given what these people are dealing with, but there's no doubt that presidencies in many ways are judged by how you respond
sure.
to these big tragedies. And there's no doubt that Donald Trump is working and going overboard to make it, give at least the appearance that he is completely tuned in and involved in what's going on here. But, you know, we can't forget, Steve, that the two main entities that would be responsible for this, the Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Emergency Management Association, neither of them have full-time directors in place right now.
Right.
So this is an example of how, you know, the uncertainty in the Trump White House, when there's actually a big thing happening, you know, could lead to trouble.
Right, because you have to have these places staffed, and as you've taught me and have said many times, it's the undersecretaries and the administrative level folks that do the lion's share of the work here. And it's not just the State Department, it's FEMA and Homeland Security and other places that don't have enough bodies to do the job. The president's trip for tomorrow, there's a concern that, you know, the president, because of the resources it draws away from others, it could be a distraction. Is it timed right? Is it poorly timed? I mean, he is. And be careful now. I defended Madigan a few minutes ago, and I'm going to defend Trump. He's in a bit of no man's land here in that he really has to go, but should he?
I mean, you're right, Steve. I think it's difficult to criticize the president's response in terms of physically going to Texas because, you know, we cannot forget George W. Bush and how he was just lampooned for flying over top of Hurricane Katrina instead of landing there. But the reason that he did that was because he was advised that if he went, it would cause too much of a distraction for the actual work being done on the ground. You know, the White House believes that this trip, the places he's going to go are going to be far enough removed from where the actual tragedy is taking place that it's not going to interfere at all with the necessary work that the first responders are doing. But kind of going back to what we said before, Steve, it's not as if this is over and we can now take a step back and figure out what it's going to take to recover. This is an ongoing situation. It could be ongoing through the weekend. So
right.
Is it necessary for him to go this early? Obviously, the White House believes it is, and the leaders on the ground believe it is, you know. But, you know, it's, again, hard to talk about these things in terms of political terms. But you have all Republicans in positions of authority in Texas. That does give the president a degree of cover because I don't expect Texas Governor Greg Abbott to come out and hammer the Trump administration's response to this.
The money that FEMA needs is incalculable at this point. What do we know about the resources? Because Texas is not infinitely wealthy either. You know, are we going to be able to pay for this?
Well, it's interesting. This also is a political debate. And I don't know if you saw over the weekend, Peter King was the congressman from Long Island in New York, who is a Republican but hates Ted Cruz. Tweeted over the weekend that despite the fact that Ted Cruz did not vote for additional funding to fund the recovery after Superstorm Sandy, that he was going to take the high ground and still vote for any type of funding that would be necessary to help the people of Texas recover. So this is an odd situation for somebody like Ted Cruz to be in, who's a fiscal hawk, who did fight to a certain degree about that funding for Superstorm Sandy. I just have to imagine that everything that's going on right now, and especially the response from the Trump administration, you have all Republicans in charge there, that whatever funding is necessary from the federal government is going to come through. But, you know, Steve, we've said before that it should be easy for them to get stuff done, and they haven't got a whole heck of a lot done. So I don't think we're going to know that for sure until they actually get the ball rolling.
And the absolute truth here is there's not a lot that anybody can do until it stops raining. And that could be Thursday morning, Thursday afternoon. It's unbelievable. If you would all subscribe to any belief system that involves prayer, pray for Texas is not just a hashtag. It really is devastating.
If I could also say, to Steve, you know, that's one thing that my network does really well is just get as many people on the ground there. And we have so many really hardworking photographers and reporters and producers. This would have been my beat back in my days when I was covering for our local affiliates. So it's a little weird not to be down there. But I know, you know, there are actual stories of our reporters and producers, Ed Lavandera, our Texas Bureau guy. They actually are rescuing people as they go and tell this story.
Right.
And this is another example of how important journalism is. You know, if it weren't for our reporters telling that story, I don't think the rest of the world would know just how bad this is. So I just have to give a degree of credit to my hardworking colleagues who are working, you know, 18-hour days to get this story out to the rest of the world.
Yeah, and as I'm sure you know, we've been doing that as well because CNN is better at this than anybody. And by the way, the coverage that CNN provides also creates the awareness that generates millions and millions and millions of dollars into the Red Cross, and that money is going to be needed more than ever. There's also an easy click on the CNN webpage on ways you can help for those of you who are inclined to help this morning. So I hope you'll go there at CNN.com. All right, Friday night, the president made several decisions on Friday. You know, people can call this a news dump on your network. There were others who said that maybe he was just trying to keep attention away from the storm and on him. In the big picture, none of that matters. The matters is the decisions. Let's start with the minor one. Seb Gorka is kicked out. Was this guy a big deal, or did he just never shut up?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the reason that he's gone is that he really wasn't that big of a deal. You know, our White House team has said that one of the big things that John Kelly did was walk around to every single one of these people who had important-sounding titles in the West Wing and say, show me what you're working on. What exactly are you accomplishing? And I don't know if Seb Gorka was a guy that could hand a folder over to John Kelly and show this record of accomplishment. You know, for the most part, right. He was a mouthpiece on television who talked a good game. Trump liked his kind of in-your-face presentation on television, and that's one of the reasons he stuck around. And when Steve Bannon left, you know, his role became very marginalized. He didn't have the same kind of responsibility in the Trump orbit that Bannon did. So when Bannon was gone, he didn't have a patron. So I think at that point, it just became pretty obvious that he was an expendable commodity in the White House.
The transgender directives have come down. That story continues to develop. But I got to ask you about Arpaio before I let you go. Sheriff Joe Arpaio has a very, very dicey record of accomplishments in the midst of a lot of things he never had to answer for, and he was convicted of a crime. Will this pardon stand as presidential pardons do?
I mean, everything that I've read and what the legal experts have said, that this is well within the purview of the president of the United States, but I think it's also a perfect example of how elections have consequences. You know, the country voted to give Donald Trump this level of responsibility. And even though it's being roundly condemned, not only by Democrats and people on the ground in Arizona, but Republicans, both Republican senators in Arizona. For Pete's sake, the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, said it was a bad idea. I think it's going to stand. Trump seems pretty defiant. And this is a power that is entrusted in him through the Constitution. So I think it's going to stand. The question is, will there be any type of a political fallout? This is another example of a Trump move that fires his base up in a big way. They agree with him wholeheartedly. And maybe the rest of the country, the other 71%, think it's ridiculous. So does it move the ball at all? I mean, there's a good chance, Steve, that we're going to be in the same exact place we were before he made the decision.
If you follow me on Twitter at Cochran Show, I linked, as many did, to the Phoenix Free Times, I believe, is the newspaper that has covered Arpaio for 15 or 20 or 25 years. And the litany of things he did while in power are absolutely outrageous. And the Republicans had the Hispanic vote, lost the Hispanic vote, maybe got it back. This ain't going to help. And this could have a big impact on 2018. Thank you, Ryan, for all of that. Glad you're back and safe. And let's pray for Houston.
All right. Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it. Have a great week.
We're back after this. We'll do news. And then Dean joins us on 720 WGN.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Dean Richards joins us from Channel 9.
Citizens of the world,
some of the world's greatest entertainers are here tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you?
And tonight, guess what? It's going to be Dean.
Yeah, honey, you know I love you more than what I should. Yeah, Hollywood, well, kiss me good.
8:16 now, Dean Richards live from Channel 9, and
welcome
then we're
going to
go back. Thank you, my friend. And we're going to go back to Ryan Burrow in Texas here in a few minutes.
Yes.
I accomplished something yesterday while traveling, which I don't recommend others try. I was playing golf yesterday flying out of Syracuse, New York, about a half an hour, maybe 35 minutes from the airport. And in the process of renting golf clubs, because I look shady, they asked for identification. I gave them my driver's license. And when I gave them my driver's license, I thought, don't forget your driver's license. You won't be able to get on the plane. Don't forget your driver's license. You won't be able to get on the plane. Got to the airport, realized I didn't have my driver's license. That was at 4 o'clock for a 5:30 flight. Still had the car.
What'd you do?
drove to the golf course at speeds exceeding the speed limit, contacted the golf course where the head professional there met me at the toll plaza to save me 10 minutes and gave me the driver's license, got back, made the plane by 4 minutes.
Wow.
I don't recommend it. Not good for your stress level.
Isn't that right, like on the New York State Thruway?
Yes, it is. Yes, yeah. Yes, it is.
So the speed limit would be?
65.
You're probably 66.
I was going 140.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Which for a rental car, I was impressed. But, you know, it was a Chevy Malibu, and you know how I feel about Chevy products. So, Dean, as always, never travel with me. I'll make your blood pressure go up.
Steve, I cannot condone you breaking the law like that.
I know you can't.
I have to admonish you for that.
You ever tried traveling without your driver's license? Doesn't go well unless you get your passport.
It's like a panic attack kind of thing. When you realize driver's license or, oops, where's my wallet? Especially if there's air travel involved, because you know a strip search is going to come right behind that.
I've always tried to get that to happen, and they'll never bite. But that's why I've advocated for years vending machines for passports right in the airport.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can make a lot of money.
All right. Let's go with Game of Thrones. Was the finale last night?
The season 7 finale was last night. I'm not giving any spoiler alerts.
Lots of people died?
Okay. Sure.
Were dragons involved?
Dragons were involved.
That's the greatest catchphrase. Game of Thrones, were dragons involved? That's tremendous.
Well, we've got until possibly 2019 to ponder
is that right?
Whether or not dragons will be coming back. HBO has confirmed that the final season could air as early as the summer of 2018. Or as late as 2019. They haven't decided yet. They also did confirm that the final season, season 8, will only be 6 episodes long. But each episode could be feature film length. So
really? Like a couple of hours apiece?
Big boffo ending.
Wait, this last one was only how many episodes? Like
7
or 8? Yeah.
I should probably start
shorter
watching
every year. Yeah, so it'll be easier to watch.
How many years has it been on? I should probably start watching it.
Well, this is season 7 just came to an end last night.
I don't have that kind of time. It's too late to catch up. I'm going to have to move on to another dragon.
You are so anti-dragon. It's terrible.
It really is. I need to talk to someone about that. The VMAs were on last night. Remember when MTV used to show videos? Remember that?
No, I don't.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
I really don't.
But the Video Music Awards are last night, and they hand out awards for videos that you can't see anywhere, right? Other than online, I guess?
Pretty much online. I can't really say that I watch MTV enough to know if someplace they still run videos.
I don't think so.
Honestly, I don't think they do. But if they did, Kendrick Lamar would just be in super high rotation. Because he was the big winner last night. Mm. He went into the night with 8 nominations, more than anyone else. He came out of the awards with 6 wins in all, more than anyone else. And that includes the top prize of the night, Video of the Year, for his song Humble. You know that song Humble, don't you?
Sure. Oh, yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Humble. Humble. Waka, waka, waka. Humble.
It is one of my favorites.
My impression of a rap song. He also took, I like how I made it sound like a Stephen Eady song.
Yeah, kind of did.
He also won Best Hip Hop Video, Best Direction, Cinematography, Art Direction, and Visual Effects. Seriously, I know a lot of you go, I'm not into hip hop music and not into rap music at all. This is a stunning video, a stunning piece of cinematography that they
Speaking of piece, P-I-E-C-E. Worst box office weekend since the talkies started.
Right.
What is
since
that?
Al Jolson's The Jazz Singer.
Is that because terrible movies are out? That because the way we watch movies has changed?
No, well, it's probably a little bit of that.
Is that because it's summer and people are doing stuff? Is that because nobody in Texas went to a movie this weekend, obviously?
Well, you've answered my question. You've answered your own question with all those very astute responses. Mm-hmm. The biggest reason, all of those things are true. The biggest reason is most of the movies out right now really are awful.
Okay.
Nobody's that interested. People are going to see Dunkirk. People are going to see Girls Trip. You know, there's a few good ones. Some people, Wonder Woman's still out there, and you can still see that. But, you know, from this past weekend, the only major new release was a so-so animated film called Leap. They re-released Terminator 2 in 3D. That did nothing at the box office. The number one movie of the weekend, the Ryan Reynolds, Samuel L. Jackson film, only made, just barely made $10 million, which is nothing. It's another drought, and it's going to be drought for one more weekend, and then things are going to start to pick up again in September.
We're already out of time. We got to get to Texas. But Russell Brand got married, and what happened to Lady Gaga's mom?
Lady Gaga did a concert, of course, at Wrigley Field on Friday night, and that was a huge event among the many huge concerts this weekend. But I thought, like, maybe the coolest story of the whole weekend, Lady Gaga's mom, while Gaga was here, goes to a homeless shelter for homeless LGBTQ 18 to 24 year olds. Takes them backpacks, takes them supplies, takes them stuff to get back on their feet and get on with their lives, and throws a big barbecue for them. Good for Lady Gaga's mom.
No doubt.
Nice story.
It's a new band, Lady Gaga's mom. Thank you, buddy. Get back to work.
See you tomorrow.
And Dave.
Dean's Entertainment Report, sponsored by Hyundai.
Traffic from Mary, then we got you up with Ryan Burrow in Houston. Ryan Burrow, standing by. All right, even better. Ryan Burrow is in Houston. Ryan, where are you?
I'm still at the evacuation center, getting a little bit more information about this reservoir release, though. We're getting some information. The mayor's actually going to have a press conference in about an hour. So if you're not familiar with the situation, they've got these reservoirs with these dams, and the water's obviously been flowing and picking up very heavily. It sounds like about 4 inches an hour on average. And the concern is that the dams could burst. There's concerns that they can't handle this kind of capacity. So what they're doing, and they've never done it before, is actually manually releasing the water into neighborhoods, and they've told the people in these neighborhoods, look, this is a voluntary evacuation, but you could be underwater here very shortly. And they started doing that early this morning. They're going to continue doing that into the afternoon, and they say that the full effects are probably being felt right now.
But for people and this is a tragic development, but frankly it can't be helped, and for people that want to leave now, is it too late?
Well, it's very difficult to leave just by the sheer fact that there are no roads really to get in and out of. And many of the people who are in flooding situations have their cars flooded as well. You know, it's not just their homes that are flooded, but the cars in the garage. If you're able to finally get your car out of the garage, where are you going to go? So, just movement right now is a real issue. And police and fire officials are doing everything they can to help people move through the city. But beyond that, there's really nothing they can do.
The people of Houston being under attack like this, that's going to go on for several more days. This is when neighbors help neighbors. And there's been this amazing story of anybody with a boat going pretty much door to door to rescue folks. Is that working out?
Yeah, it is. And very appreciative, the police department and emergency crews, FEMA as well, that people are either A, able to loan their boat or larger vehicles to do this, and B, do it themselves, especially neighborhood to neighborhood. Now, unfortunately, we've got 3 deaths right now, and that does seem very low for something this magnitude, but not until they're able to actually go door to door, officials, and check on people, are we really going to understand whether or not this was a successful effort or a deadly one. And that was kind of one of the issues we saw in New Orleans, right? It wasn't until days later when, people were found trapped in attics and there were a lot of fatalities involved that maybe were not there initially. So that's the concern moving forward.
Yeah, and a lot of the folks that you end up losing in cases like this are folks that are non-ambulatory, or they're older folks who kind of keep to themselves. And in the midst of a panic of trying to get your own family out, you're probably not thinking about getting the old guy next door out with you.
Yeah, and they're encouraging people, especially people with elderly neighbors, to check on that. I don't know if you've seen the images from that the nursing home where
those elderly
people were sitting essentially in this flood water waiting to be rescued. Now, it sounds as though they all were, but the images are just absolutely unbelievable.
You can text the word Harvey to 90999 to make an easy $10 donation right now, H-A-R-V-E-Y. Hurricane Harvey's devastating effects on Houston continue. Is the mood at the center that you're at now just basically people being stunned, or what are they like?
Yeah, essentially that's it. You know, some people are wrapped in blankets. They're just trying to find a place to get out of the conditions. I think that the anger and frustration will set in eventually. But, I mean, these people have essentially been on no sleep for 24, 48 hours. Many of them started taking water into their home yesterday, tried to battle it as best they could. And at some point, you just throw up your arms and say, okay, you know, Mother Nature wins. I'm out of here. And so where do I go? And that's why these people are here. Now they've got to get food. They've got to get some sleep. And actually what the Red Cross is doing is they're providing them with information as well as to life moving forward. They've dealt with this. They know what it's like. This is obviously catastrophic, but it's something that the Red Cross prepares for. And so they're giving them information about insurance, picking their life back together. Sure. And they say this is not a sprint. This is a marathon. They're prepared to be here for weeks, maybe months if necessary. And just based on the amount of water we've seen, it could very well take that long before anything is restored to what seemed to be normal.
That's Ryan Burrow. Thank you, my friend. I know you got to jump to your other duties with ABC News, covering it for ABC and also 720 WGN. 8:45 now. We continue live from the Allstate Showcase Studio. We like featuring cool stories about, the perfect title for it, badass women. And Eva Shockey's on the phone. Let me ask you a question. How do you bond with your dad? Eva Shockey has an incredible career and approaching a couple of million social media followers. And her new book is called Taking Aim, Daring to Be Different, Happier, and Healthier in the Great Outdoors. Good morning, and how are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I'm wonderful.
Thanks for being on. And your husband's gearing up for hockey season, I assume?
He actually just retired last summer, so he has a real job now. He does commercial real estate.
Oh, I thought he was doing some NHL Network stuff. No, huh?
Nope. He retired about a year ago, right when we found out we were pregnant, and he got a real job, and we moved and settled in a little bit into Raleigh, North Carolina, so now we have a normal life.
Well, I wouldn't call your life normal so much. Eva Shockey, most of you have heard the name, and for those of you who haven't, I would highly recommend that you see the show that you do with your dad, which is called?
Jim Shockey's Hunting Adventures on Outdoor Channel.
Now, weren't you, from what I understand, you were more of a girly girl when you were a kid, right?
I was. I know we're talking about my book on here, and I wrote about that at the beginning of the book because I wanted to be a professional dancer. I was in ballet and jazz, and I was competing in Latin dance, and I thought that's the direction I was going to go, and I decided I wanted to try hunting just one time, and that was 9 years ago, and now that's my entire career and my whole life, and I'm very, very glad I made that decision.
And people should understand that if you go, oh, hunting's not for me, that's not what this book is about. This book takes you through some of your adventures, but it's also another one that we would recommend to give girls an inspiration to go out there and chase your dreams.
Yeah, absolutely. I really did write the book kind of for everyone. It's definitely for hunters that already love hunting and love the outdoors. But it's for people who are thinking about hunting or people that are, it's important to them that they live an organic, healthy lifestyle, because essentially hunters, all we're doing that's different from anyone else that goes to the grocery store is we're closing that gap between the meat on our dinner table and where that food came from, what the animal that it came from. We're closing that and we're going straight to the source. So that's essentially why I started. I wanted to know where my meat came from, and now I do, and it's the leanest meat you can get on the planet.
Your dad welcoming when you wanted to do this, or was he skeptical?
Absolutely welcoming. He tried to get me to hunt my whole life, and I think he gave up when I was about 18. He just thought there was no way I was ever going to do it at that point. And at 20 years old, I came home from university, and I said, Dad, I want to learn how to hunt. I want you to teach me. And I just remember it was like a cartoon where his jaw dropped to the floor and he just saw his eyes like, what are you talking about? And he took me out. And I mean, I think that day he had our first trip booked because he didn't want me to change my mind. And we went from there. And that was when I was 21, I went on my first hunt, and I'm 29 now. So it's just been more and more nonstop. And it honestly is the best lifestyle. I get to spend it with my family. I get to be outdoors in fresh air. Physically challenging, mentally challenging, and at the end of the day, if you harvest an animal, you get to eat it and enjoy it and appreciate it. It's incredible.
And I assume you're probably not taking your phone out in the woods to tweet or text.
Most of the times when we're hunting, there's no service. So right. It's not really an option. No one can really be tweeting or texting, which you're right. It's one of the best parts about it. We call it unplugging because, I mean, we all are very busy outside of the actual traveling and hunting. We're on our computers a lot, doing a lot of work for companies and our partner companies and whatnot. But when you're out there, you unplug, you disconnect. No one can access you. The only people you're with is whoever you're hunting with. And you don't get that a lot these days. There's just so much access to us through emails and Facebook and Instagram and cell phones and just in general. But when you're out there, you just don't have that. And it's really nice to just stop, take a breath, and go back in time a little bit to before we got so busy.
There's been a lot of talk about leveling the playing field in show business as far as women's pay goes. Amy Schumer came out and said, look, Dave Chappelle made this much for a Netflix special. I ought to make this much for a Netflix special. Well, she's not wrong. You know, it is what the market will bear, but you're certainly a star in your own right. Have other hunters outside of your dad, have other hunters and other folks who are, you know, maybe doing endorsements on your level and different things, have they welcomed you?
They have. You know, one thing I will say, that if you're looking to get paid a whole bunch of money, the hunting industry is not the one you should be going
right.
for.
You'll eat good. You won't necessarily get a bunch of dough.
Yes, exactly. I mean, if you're in the hunting industry and you're doing similar things to what I do with my family, I mean, you're in it because you love it. It's a lifestyle. It's a healthy, organic, family-oriented, positive lifestyle, and that's why we're in it. I mean, if I wanted to make a bunch of money, there's probably different career paths I would have chosen. But I will say, as far as men versus women, when I started in the industry, or when I grew up in the industry, I should say, before I was even a hunter, I would go to events and there'd be, you know, 50-1, probably men to women. And now I go, and it's pretty close to 50-50. And
that's changed
in the last 5 or so years. And it's incredible, because there's all these women standing up and saying, you know, we're proud of what we do. We belong here in the industry. Companies are producing products and gear and clothing specifically for women that fit us and is meant for us. And it's pretty cool to see the change. The fastest growing demographic in the hunting industry is women.
But you don't have to deal with the you're a beautiful woman, and you're in a very male dominant industry for the most part. You don't have to deal with any of the problems that come with that.
There's definitely a stereotype around hunting. I mean, I think goes back in time with Elmer Fudd and whoever else, sort of middle-aged.
Elmer Fudd, one of the great hunters.
You know, yeah, which there's nothing wrong with being a middle-aged white man hunter, but it's still possible to be a hunter and be male, be female, be young, be old, be from any ethnicity anywhere around the world, and you don't have to apologize for that or be insecure with the fact that you're not the stereotypical hunter. And so I definitely get people that are a little bit shocked, but as soon as I show them why I love it and talk about why I love it and show them that I'm there the same reason that they're there, it doesn't matter if I'm a girl or if I'm, you know, 20 years old and wear makeup and have blonde hair. I love to be in the woods, and that's something that I stand for very strongly. And it's, I think people have come around, and it's a lot different attitude than it was probably 20 years ago.
And the book's called Taking Aim. Got just a minute or so left with Eva Shockey. Now, Eva, your husband, even though he just retired from the NHL, I make the argument there's no professional sport more physically demanding than the National Hockey League. So he's a tough guy. And he sees you, meets you. I don't know how he met you, but you're a hot girl. Maybe he's got game. Maybe he doesn't. When he finds out what you do and what you love to do, was that off-putting? Was that a hump you had to get over, or was he cool with it?
Well, we met actually at a hunting event. A hunting
oh, you did?
Show I was there appearing at. Yeah, he's a hunter, a big fisherman, and you're right. He's very tough. It's not – he obviously right off the bat knew what I did. It's more the negative things that come at me, the haters and the death
sure.
threats and those kind of horrible messages that I'll get on a daily basis. Those are the things that bother him. I mean, the rest he knows are just people trying to be funny or hit on me or whatever they're trying to do. And I mean, it's no big deal, because obviously it stays where it starts. But as far as the death threats, he gets a little bit upset about those. I know that he has to do everything in his power. And if it was really in person and someone said that, things would be a lot different. But he's learned to try to hold his tongue on social media, because I mean, they're just protecting themselves behind their computers, and it's something that they're
cowards
about.
Listen, anybody does. I don't care who you are, whether you're assaulting a celebrity or you're assaulting a kid at school, you're a coward.
Yes,
and you know, there's no excuse for it. The book's called Taking Aim. It's Eva Shockey. As always, I see. Get 2 copies. You're careless. You'll lose one. Download it. Buy it. Spread it around. Tell your friends. It's a great, inspiring book for girls and for women and for really anybody. And if you love hunting, you certainly got to get it. Taking Aim, Eva Shockey. Thank you, Eva.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate you being on.
Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio, this is the Steve Cochran Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
9:12 now as we continue live from the Allstate Showcase Studio. Happy to have a legend in studio. You know, I like to take this 9 o'clock hour many days, if not most days, and introduce you to people that we think you ought to know. And certainly one with us right now. He is Gabe Spataro, a Korean War vet whose story is much deeper than that. And also joining us with him, Gabe, is Jim Elliott, president of Dive Heart. And you can go to diveheart.org. There's some amazing stories to tell there, and Jim's got a few himself. Jim, would you put that microphone right in front of Gabe, if you would? Just pull that right over there so he's talking right into it, and then get him as close to it as you can there. Just lean up. Gabe, you've got some vision issues, right? That's the only thing you're dealing with both ways.
Yeah, macular degeneration.
Does that make you legally blind at this point?
Yeah, I'm legally blind.
All right. Now,
I'm a veteran, and the VA, I go there to the hospital,
yeah.
And they sent me to Hines,
sure.
Where they have a building for blind veterans, and they teach us how to use a cane and how to put marks on different doors and stuff so you know where you're at.
Yeah, you can navigate around.
Yeah. And
you look like you're in great health. How old are you?
85.
85 yeah. Years old.
What I tell people is I celebrated my 46th anniversary of my 39th birthday, June 20th.
You don't need to make any excuses. You still got your hair. Where did you serve?
Korea.
All right. And
yeah, I was a draftee.
Okay. In what branch?
In the Army, in the helicopters.
Oh, you're a chopper guy.
Well, see, I was drafted in the Army, and they sent me to Korea in January of 54.
Okay.
And I was replacing a supply sergeant in a helicopter company. And I was doing a pretty good job, so they made me a corporal.
Oh, really? Bumped
and
you
then,
up there.
And then we changed from a company to a battalion,
mm-hmm.
And they made me a supply sergeant of a helicopter battalion.
Okay.
So I went from a corporal to a sergeant.
Yeah, pretty good bump.
And I wasn't even in the Army a year and a half.
Yeah, well, you know what? Able-bodied. But you obviously distinguish yourself well there. But what I'm trying to figure out where you developed your love for the water.
I don't know. I guess... I swam. I went to the YMCA when I was 7 years old and learned how to swim.
Okay.
And
but you're telling me off the air when you got home from Korea, you bought a boat.
Well, yeah, we bought a 34-foot sailboat. My two brothers and I, we were all in service at the same time, and we got out about the same time. And they're older than I am. And we have an Italian restaurant in Chicago.
What was the restaurant?
Sparga's Pizzeria, yeah, actually Sparga's Italian restaurant.
Used to drop off pizzas here, I heard.
Oh, yeah. That was back in the 50s. It's a program called Spin Time on Saturday afternoon.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. And it was a
looks
lot
like
of fun.
Looks like we missed out on the pizza. but I bet the recipe is still good. But eventually you come to become quite a diver.
Well, that happened. See, at the restaurant, I would go around and say hello to the people and say, how'd you like the pizza? And, you know, what are you doing tomorrow? And there was a young couple eating pizza, and I went up to them and introduced myself. And they said, Gabriel, this is the most delicious pizza we've ever had.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I really got into a conversation with them.
Sure.
And then I asked them, what are you guys doing tomorrow? And they said, oh, we're going on a picnic. Well, you know, a picnic is beer and hot dogs.
Sure, sitting in the park.
But he mentioned the word scuba, self-contained underwater breathing apparatus.
Right.
Now, I had never heard this word. I didn't know anything about diving scuba, but I like to swim.
Right.
So I horned in on their picnic. They came pick me up the next day, and they took me out to Lake Geneva. And Art, the fella's name, he put fins on me. I never had fins before.
Right.
He put a weight belt on me. He put a tank on my back. He put a mask and a snorkel on my head. And he said, Gabriel, the only instruction I'm going to give you is don't stop breathing.
Now, here, right.
You're going underwater. Who right. wants to stop breathing?
Right.
But that is very important, how you breathe.
And you fell in love with it right away.
Well, then we got into water. And I couldn't breathe. So I came up. I said, all right, I can't breathe. He said, did you turn the tank on? I mean, who knows about turning a tank on?
So it's my first day.
So he came over and turned the tank on, and we went down. And Lake Geneva isn't the most pristine place, but it was, for the first time, really terrific.
Yeah, and there's a great story about a pretty significant dive you made not too long ago. But let's back this up a little farther, too.
Well,
the
then,
Christ of the Deep statue.
Well, that's
you were significant, along with several others, in bringing the Christ of the Deep statue over here, where it's become the most visited underwater tourist attraction ever.
The thing about the statue, in 60, a friend of mine was going to be president of the Underwater Society of America,
okay.
Carl Hauber.
Okay.
And he said, Gabriel, at my convention, I want you to be my chairman. And we were going to have the convention in August of 62.
Okay.
And we were going to have it at the Palmer House. And then he told me, he said, you know, Kresge, the swim fin manufacturer, is donating a 9-foot bronze statue of Christ to the the Underwater Society Council. And I'm going to present that at the convention. I'd like you to take care of it. So this was 60. And I was going to take a trip to Europe to be a wine connoisseur. And I figured, well, I might as well go visit where the statue's being made.
Right.
So I went to Genoa, and I met Kresge and Guido Galletti, who was the artist.
These are all real names, Dave.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And I don't think there's any phony about them. I had lunch with them. But anyhow, they showed me a picture of the statue. And
sure.
I said, oh, that's beautiful. You
sure.
know.
Sure.
I said, how are you getting it to Chicago? And Kresge said, Gabe, we're giving it to you, but you got to get it there.
Right, right. Moving's not included.
Yeah. So when I came back to Chicago, I called Carl up and I said, you know, that's a beautiful statue. But he said, we've got to get it to Chicago. They're giving it to us, but we got to get it here. And I said, how much money do we have? And he said, well, we don't have any. So anyhow, I was telling my father the story about the Italians giving the statue to the Americans. And my father knew a lot of Italian people. And he said, Gabriel, why don't you go downtown and talk to the American Express, the friend of ours down there, and see if they can't help you.
Yeah, a little sponsorship.
So I went down and shook hands with the guy. And he said, Gabriel, sit down and tell me, when do you want the statue, but not tomorrow?
Right.
My father told him the whole story that the Italians were giving it to the Americans. So I said, no, our convention is in August, so if I get it the first week of August of 62, that's fine. He says, okay, don't worry about it. You'll get it.
How about that? How about stepping up? How about
now,
stepping up and getting it done?
This statue is in a 16-foot crate by 6 feet by 4 feet, several tons on one end.
Sure.
And that's,
you're not putting that in a FedEx envelope.
Yeah, and that's coming from Genoa, Italy to Navy Pier, Chicago.
All right, now how's it end up off the coast of Key Largo?
Well, the thing was, I went to the president. I said, you know, we're going to get the statue here, but where is it going to be put? Because
right.
Lake Michigan isn't the place for the statue.
Right, right, right.
And he said, well, Gabriel, we've got 3 clubs that are interested, one in California, one in Texas, and one in Florida. So I just happened to have a little free time, and I flew out to California, you know, just one of those accident things.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went diving with the guys in California, and the Pacific Ocean was nice and clear and warm, but it was like a forest of kelp, maybe 7 or 8 feet tall.
Right, and you got to be able to see it. You can't drop the statue in the kelp bed. You got to be able to see it.
So then I made a contact in Florida, and I mean in Texas, and I flew down, and the fella had a 100-foot sailboat, you know, 3-masted schooner.
Sure.
And we went sailing and diving out in the Gulf of Mexico.
Another scouting run.
But now that was plain ground, you know, just clean sand.
Right.
No, nothing, just clean sand. And
right.
It was
right.
Nice, clear water, but
right.
That was it. And then I made a contact with John Pennekamp and one of the directors of the Florida Parks and Recreation and Museums.
That's the Key Largo connection.
And then we had lunch, and I showed them a picture of the statue, and they said, oh, Gabriel, that's got to go with, you know, John Pennekamp Coral Reef State Park. And I agreed with him. So when I came back to Chicago, I told the president, Carl, and he called Pennekamp on the phone, and they talked, and then he sent a letter in 60, it was it January of 62, 60, no, January 62, he sent a letter.
Right.
And asked them if they would accept, you know, if you know, we would give them the statue. And they agreed, and so we set it all up at the hotel that the Kresge would give it to the Underwater Society, and Underwater Society would give it to Florida.
And when did it actually go in the water?
It took 2.5 years after we got the statue here. It went in the water in July of 65.
When we come back, Jim Elliott's going to explain how Gabe finally got to dive and see the Christ statue off Key Largo. It's a pretty cool story. And as Jim put it, a bunch of old guys were going down there, and they were going to die. I think I was going to go with them. So anyway, we'll come back. We'll talk with more of the amazing Gabe Spataro. And don't forget about Dive Heart here. We'll talk more about Dive Heart, too. DiveHeart.org. More coming up. Steve Cochran Show, 720 WGN and CLTV. Back in the Allstate Showcase studio, Gabe Spataro is here, Korean War vet. He's now legally blind, and that won't keep him out of the water. And we're talking about this amazing story where Gabe, for the first time, got to dive into, well, the past and the present when his visit to the Statue of Christ off Key Largo in the water was viewed for the first time. So let's back it up for a second and bring in Jim Elliott here. Jim is the boss at Dive Heart. What do you do at Dive Heart, Jim?
I'm the founder and president.
All right. And what does the company do?
We're a nonprofit, a 501c3. We help build confidence, independence, and self-esteem in children, adults, and vets with disabilities. And we actually use it as a therapy. It's not about scuba diving.
We were talking off the air about this a second ago. There's been amazing discoveries with autistic kids, mm-hmm. For pain management, and a number of different things. That pretty much every time you dive, you find out something new about diving.
Mm-hmm. Illinois School of Psychology researchers found that the very first pool session is very powerful. It creates a paradigm shift. It's not Johnny in a wheelchair anymore. It's Johnny the scuba diver.
Right.
Once he does that, he thinks he can go on and take on other challenges, right? If I can scuba dive, I can do anything. So with social media, we take photos and video, give it to the kid or the vet or whatever, and all of a sudden, they're like rock stars. They roll into a party, and it's like, what'd you do this weekend? Oh, I went diving.
Yeah. It's a big deal.
Yeah, it's like, how do you dive? You know, you're a quadriplegic.
It brings people out of their shell, and it's a great story to tell.
Yeah.
All right, so how did you meet our friend Gabe?
Well, I was teaching a bunch of blind veterans at Hines VA Hospital, and I met Gabe, and he starts to tell me that he's been diving since the 50s, and I'm like, well, why am I certifying you now?
Right, it's like putting a master chef in a beginning cooking right. class, right?
So he says, well, you didn't need certification back then. I said, well, you know, you're right. That was like bootleg diving back in the early days.
Yeah.
So then he starts to tell me about he brought the Christ statue, the journey. You know, he brought it from Italy over to the U.S., and I'm going, you brought the Christ statue over. It's the most viewed underwater object in the world, probably generated $1 billion in tourism since the 60s when it went down.
And, goes, by the way, Gabe didn't get any of that.
No, and I didn't believe him until he started bringing in photographs. I went, oh, my God. And then I'm driving him home in 2013 from a fundraiser, and he says, I'm going to dive the Christ statue. And I go, well, you probably dove it 50 times. You brought it here in the 60s. He goes, I've never dove it. I go, what? He goes, yeah, I'm going with my buddy Vinny, who's got one leg, and my buddy Louie, who's also blind. And we're taking Vinny's fishing boat, which is like 8 feet long, and we're going to go 8 miles out in the ocean. And I go, you're going to die. And I'm like,
if I survive Korea, I'll be fine.
Yeah, so I called my vendor, Rainbow Reef. They cleared paid spots and took us out. And we had a chase boat with like so many cameras. Miami Herald ran a front page story.
Sure, yeah, AP, you can see it online. Yeah.
Amazing story.
And you went out with him. And for the first time, Gabe got to see the statue. He was absolutely instrumental in getting here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He was... you know, this man, if there's anybody that does documentaries that listen to your show, he definitely is a candidate for that.
No kidding.
If not a feature film.
This is perfect for the Outdoor Channel. This is just a great feature story for anybody. But anyway, Gabe, lean into that microphone again, if you would, for me for a second. And tell me what it felt like when you saw that statue underwater.
Well, it's a personal thing.
Sure.
It's not a religious thing.
Yeah.
It's a personal thing between you and the statue that... inside you, your whole body is just warmed, and you feel I can't really explain it.
But it should make you feel good. I know Jim started to mention this as well.
It really
because
does.
Of the amount of tourism that's gone through there, you really have changed lives. You've changed lives to have an opportunity for people who do that dive to actually see that Christ statue underwater. The most visited underwater tourist attraction ever.
Well, we never thought of it that way when we were doing it. We just thought we had a job to do. And we had something to present to the American divers. And, I mean, I didn't do it alone.
Sure,
I had people who helped me, you know, like the steamship line brought it from, you know, Italy to Navy
right.
Pier.
Right, right.
And then when it was at Navy Pier, they had a truck that brought it to the hotel free. And then at the hotel, I went to the manager and said, you know, we've got this 9-foot bronze statue we want to dedicate at our convention, at our banquet. And he said, well, we're a union house. You just get the union people to move it and put it in the, you know, the banquet hall.
That's so deals in Chicago were made by handshakes and just get it done.
Well, I went to the union and they said, well, that's about an $1,800 job. We'll only charge you $900.
Mm.
Now, $900 to take it up 2 floors in a hotel.
Big deal.
And it came across the ocean 5,000 miles.
Right.
So one of my guys was a baggage handler for TWA, and he was union. So I took him into the manager's office, and I said, this is my union guy. He's going to handle the statue. And we were all young. We were in our 30s, you know, so we could handle it. And we were able to do it. And then at my restaurant, I would always mention what I was doing to my customers. And one of my customers was a florist.
Okay.
And he said, well, Gabriel, since you got this beautiful statue, I'll decorate it. So he came and he put ferns and flowers and that around it. And my cousin was a newspaper reporter for the Daily News. That was when the Daily News was still here.
Sure.
And he had a friend of his who came from Africa, a missionary. And he had the missionaries make the litany for the dedication of the statue going from Italy to America.
So everybody chimed in.
And in that litany, I wish I had the copy of it. I can't find it. I had it someplace. But what it amounted to was that the statue was for those who live, work, play, fight, and die at sea. You know? And that was the basic thing for the statue in the water.
It's very moving. Very moving. You've got an amazing life, young man.
Oh, I can't complain at all.
I think you're just getting started. You know what you got to do? And I say this to all of my older friends. You got to get this down on tape. You got to have somebody sit down. I don't know if it's your nephew, your grandson, your daughter, somebody. We got to sit down with you and just let you talk about your life because this history needs to be preserved. These are great stories.
Well.
And you know what? We'll put this interview right in the middle of all of it.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know. Being in the Italian restaurant business most of my life, you know, here in Chicago, it's 7 days a week, 16 hours a day.
Yeah.
But when you had free time, I wouldn't stay in Chicago.
Yeah, you'd drive.
I would leave.
Had a little bit of the wanderlust.
Instantly, I would leave. And being a member of Columbia Yacht Club, one winter, we were sitting at the bar in Lake Michigan was frozen over. And I asked the guys, I said, what do you do in the winter when the lake freezes over? And they said, oh, we go down to Miami and get on a sailboat and race in the SORC, the Southern Ocean Racing Circuit.
Okay.
So I happened to have that area between the middle of January to the middle of February free because here in Chicago we had blizzards and ice.
I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
And that was the worst time for a restaurant, the lowest business time we had. So I would take that month between the middle of January to the middle of February and go to Florida and get on a sailboat and race in the Lipton Cup race out of Miami and race to Nassau.
You just love the water.
And then race around the island with the Governor's Cup. And here you are, 10 days, three ocean races, and you end up in the Bahamas with your scuba gear.
Pretty good life.
I mean, you
and
know,
a lot of pretty girls.
You see
around
how
too.
Difficult Gabriel's yeah. life really was.
Yeah, you know what? As a matter of fact, I'm envying you even more. It's the legend, Gabe Spataro. By the way, Spataro. Oh. Google that up and see a guy who's lived a life. And Jim Elliott from Dive Heart. And Jim, I'd love to have people support Dive Heart. So diveheart.org.
Diveheart.org. Yeah, and I think if there's only one thing, I'd love to see the Italian American Hall of Fame recognize this guy.
Absolutely.
And he's a Chicago's very own legend. I mean, he's amazing.
Legend. Yeah, and I'm watching him, too. I'm going to learn a few more things. I got to get him together with my Uncle Dana. You two would be dangerous together. It's Gabe Spataro. We got to take a break. All right, come back with the big story next on 720 WGN.
Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio, this is the Steve Cochran Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
9:46. We continue live in the Allstate Showcase Studio on 720 WGN. And more on Houston in just a second. I don't know if you guys saw the photo. Mary and I and Dave were talking about it earlier, of this assisted living facility. But there's a backstory to the story, which is on CNN.com that you can check out. It's in Dickinson, Texas. Residents there were rescued after they patiently waited for the floodwaters around them to recede. Mary, you know, knowing your mom is in a facility like this, and my mom was, it's just, you can't even imagine the fear you must have.
I just saw those pictures. I can't even picture it. And it's scary enough being in a wheelchair or using a
right.
walker.
And being dependent on others.
Yes, being dependent on others. And even in homes today, you know, you hit the buzzer, you want somebody to come and help you, and it takes them a while. Well, you know, this is taking a long time. But they were all rescued. So.
Kim McIntosh lives in Florida. She told CNN her mother, Trudy, who owns the facility, took the photo because there was no way she was getting help in time. She sent it to her daughter at 9 in the morning. She said it was a disaster. They were waiting for helicopters and the National Guard to get them out. But put this out on social media. We need help, and we need it now. And it was because of social media. And that story is being replicated thousands of times. This is the positive side of social media. People have responded. They've responded on an individual basis. They've also responded to this story in particular. But as far as we know, all of the residents there, at least for now, are okay. The one that really broke my heart was that the woman in the center of the picture, and she's either on a couch or on some kind of recliner, and she's literally knitting as the water is rising around her.
Unbelievable how calm she looked during this whole thing. And she actually
needles, right?
Yeah, she was holding the needles high up and doing it, and what patience. Wow.
Isn't there a risk of electrocution in those situations? I mean, how do they know that people, when the water is rising,
right.
how do they even know they're safe from electrical shock?
I have no idea. No idea.
That's what I
think. And what about people on oxygen, you know, in the nursing
home?
There's a lot of people on oxygen.
That's a great point. Great point. By the numbers, here's what we know about Harvey so far. It's going to keep raining in Houston. At least through Wednesday night, Thursday morning. And unless we get very lucky, we could talk about another 2 feet of rain in certain parts of the greater Houston area. So far, 11 trillion gallons of rain have been dumped on Texas. There's been over 2,000 water rescues. And again, a lot of that is because of the goodness of local residents who have boats, who have waded into the trouble themselves at their own risk to get people out. Power outages now go over 350,000. They expect that to get to 500,000 by the end of the day. 56,000 calls to Houston 911 service in about 12 hours. Typical day is about 8,000. That's 56,000 in half a day. Wind gusts got to 132 miles an hour, and 62 counties in Texas are under disaster declaration now. So, Sandberg, here's what we need to tell people. How do you help? The Red Cross.
The Red Cross, yeah.
You could also text Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
Is it 90999?
Yeah, and you can donate right there.
Yeah, and it's an instant $10 donation. There's an organization, too, called Feeding Texas, which is coordinating with local food banks. There's a Texas diaper bank distributing diaper kits and asking for diaper and cash donations. Boy, think about that, right? Mm-hmm. If you're a mom and you're a dad. And one of you is home with a new baby. and you're out of diapers. What are you going to do now?
Or formula, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Anything like that.
Yeah, what if mom went to work and you run out of formula?
Ugh.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
and don't forget about pets either.
And pets.
Yeah, Humane Society. You can go to redrover.org, humanesociety.org.
Redrover.org is right. The site?
Humane Society of the United States. All of those agencies are helping on the ground.
Facebook is lending support by activating its safety check feature. Can you explain to me how that works?
It's when if you are concerned about somebody and you can't get a hold of them, they're in an area that's, you know, in a disaster situation like Houston, you can use your social media to, they can put out there, we're okay. They may not be able to, you know, answer you on a phone or something like that, but they can say, we're still safe, you know, so.
So it's a social media well-being check.
Yeah, yeah. Similar to like when a kid is abducted and everything gets takes over, you know, and says
something's
been stolen or whatever. It's like a way of putting it out there to the masses, so.
Airbnb is offering free housing to evacuees. I don't know how this works. So people are volunteering their homes?
Yeah, in rooms, yeah.
So they do it through Airbnb. They go to Airbnb.
So you can find where an open room is.
Okay.
And then you can go and just stay there. They're allowing it.
Those interested in offering up their homes can post a listing on the site. They also set up a toll-free number, which is 855-424-7262. I mean, there could be people listening now that own property in Houston where you could do something in regards to that.
Yeah, but, and then the other big one, too, like the FEMA director said today, if you have a swift boat or you have a flat bottom boat and you're trained in that sort of use of that boat, I bet you they would be glad to see you if you drove down to Texas with that boat today.
That's an interesting point. Yeah. Now, who would you coordinate where to go and what to do with?
The way I understood the FEMA director is as soon as you get there, there'll be local law enforcement will be able to direct you. They'll probably pick you right off the road if you're headed down there.
It's a good point. You're making a good point. I bet there's a lot of people who are doing that on their own, right? Mm-hmm. They're probably just trailering the boat and getting down there.
Yeah, I think probably within, you know, an hour of Houston, you get all those people headed in. But you have to wonder if they're really overwhelmed, whether or not they want to expand that circle to other states like Illinois.
I was trying to get the Houston weather forecast up here.
I just pulled it up.
You got specifics?
Well, the rainfall totals so far, the highest rainfall total that I've seen was, I believe it's...
In inches?
Yes, 26 inches of rain.
Okay.
It's in an area called, let's see, I want to say it's Brazoria County.
Okay.
Does that sound right? I'm not sure exactly where that is in relation to Houston. But I mean, the rainfall totals, that's since the storm started.
Well, you think about 25 inches of rain since Saturday night. Saturday night is when it started raining with authority in Houston. 100% chance of precip through Thursday morning.
The National Weather Service says today in Houston, new rainfall amounts between 2 and 3 inches. Tonight, new rainfall in excess of 4 inches. Tomorrow, new rainfall in excess of 4 inches. Tomorrow night, showers and thunderstorms, 90%. 100% on Wednesday. I mean, it just goes on.
And Mike
on
Jacobson
and on.
Worked in Houston. You know, Mike, I'm not wrong. I mean, listen, I've visited Houston a million times, but I'm not wrong about this, right? The biggest problem is it's concrete and there's nowhere to go.
There's nowhere to go. And I was looking over the overhead shots and seeing on the news just like everybody else, and I saw exactly where I used to live, and it's scary. I don't know what, I mean, what do you do when the water has nowhere to go?
Here's something else that's wrapped your mind around this. Most of us in Illinois know that these thunderstorms with heavy rain come through. They're gone in a half an hour because they're traveling at about 25 or 30 miles per hour. This storm system is traveling 2 to 3 miles per hour.
And this tropical storm, unless these models are wrong, and they all seem to agree, is going to fishhook back into the Gulf and potentially re-enter Galveston and Houston and hit them again.
Right. Right.
After
it just keeps going in a big circle. Right. That's all it's doing.
Because the jet stream that usually is going across the United States
is not
kicking it out.
Even if I know it's concrete and there's nowhere for the water to go, but I don't know how many cities are prepared to take on 30 inches of rain.
Nobody.
No one.
Without disaster occurring. That's kind of just a disaster in and of itself.
It's unbelievable. So I hope any of those charities will ring with you. We'll try to do a social media post with all of them on in different ways you can help. But certainly the Red Cross is an easy go-to, or simply text Harvey to 90999 for an instant $10 donation to the Red Cross.
The difference from Katrina is that was the storm surge.
Yes.
And this has just been unbelievable amount of rain.
The storm surge for Katrina in New Orleans being below sea level in a bowl. It was like filling a bowl. Mm-hmm. But again, you remember they thought they dodged the bullet, and then the levee started to go. Once the levees broke, that's when the flooding was epic there. There's no storm like this ever in recorded history in America that can compare. Nothing. There's nothing by comparison to have a major city in America see this kind of rain centralized over the course of 5 days. It's going to get worse.